The studio. The clock reads 5 minutes to showtime, and the crew are in a frenzy.
I think we're all set here in the studio and ready to go, but we are missing one key member of the team. Where's my Crutchmans?
I'm not so sure. I heard a loud crash earlier and then saw him running in the opposite direction from the canteen. I think he was carrying something flammable. Or maybe it was inflammable.
Oh, that was a butler Centauri Megagin that the canteen staff had just restocked. I think he was carrying it back to the studio as a sort of mid-evening pick-me-up.
Uh-oh. That could be a problem. Those fire eaters were outside of the studio again earlier.
Oh no, we've got to find him and the djinn, fast. We can't start the show if there's a fire.
As the crew dash out of the studio to find the mic, they see the flames, broken glass, spilt gin and a heroic-looking Mike Rochburns grabbing a cylinder from a wall bracket, pointing the nozzle at the flames and... Well, it's not a fire extinguisher, it's an oxygen cylinder. The blast of air splatters the far wall and the flame with flaming gin. Thinking quickly, Sandy grabs Mike's cloak. Yes, he was wearing a rather fetching stripy number, the only thing to have survived the disaster, and starts flailing at the fire. Which would have worked nicely if Mike wasn't still attached to it. Needless to say, after a few minutes of flailing, the fire is indeed out. But only due to the arriving fire suppression team, Mike Rochburn's groaning is loaded onto a waiting medical gurney and taken to see Nurse Wyeth, who has special cream for the burns and a cold sponge for all the bruises. Looking a little scorched and somewhat dishevelled, the radio crew finally take their seats just as a voice says...
Our mics are live. Good evening and welcome to the show. I'm Sandy Crevice and I'm worried about the backdraft.
I'm Wilma Fingerdoo and I'm appalled at the waste of perfectly good gin.
I'm Mia Harkness and I don't have eyebrows anymore.
I'm Norma Snuckers and I've been toasting marshmallows this whole time.
Right, let's get onto the headlines before Mike starts looking for someone to reapply that cream.
New ships, no fighters. Have the NPC crew been shafted?
Corsair welcome wagon warms up.
Bienvenue à Fort Pasteur.
Gooey snack gets go-ahead.
And I rummage through the messy drawer of the BGS.
We bring you news this week of some revolting crew people, or maybe crew persons, of the hired variety. A wave of mild inconvenience has swept across the upper income tiers of lounge recliners this week as it has come to the notice of the general population, okay, one person on the forums, that the latest Supercruise overcharged optimized ships, the Python Mark II, Type 8, Mandalay, Cobra Mark V, and Gutermeyer's Corsair, enter the market with no capacity to house ship launch fighters. For the uninitiated, ship launch fighters are little fighters, unsurprisingly, that your ship can launch, also unsurprisingly, essentially disposable pocket warships with the temperament of a caffeinated Australian magpie and the structural integrity of a damp rice cracker. Designed to deploy from specially fitted bays, these agile glass hammers are piloted either remotely by the commander or by an onboard NPC crew member. They're built for speed and firepower, not longevity, and have a half-life measured in dogfights. While immensely effective at distracting enemy fire, intercepting smaller craft, or heroically exploding for dramatic effect, their survivability is roughly on par with an unshielded paper lantern in a thunderstorm. Pilots seeking to deploy in-flight combat support are finding their requests denied, not due to oversight nor budget cuts, but by structural reality. Internal bracing, enhanced power routing, and, according to one engineer, a delightful hot stone massage unit in the Corsair's power bay have made it physically incompatible with fighter bays.
Fighter bays, regrettably, were not compatible with the revised internal layout,
explained Lacon spokesperson Beryl Overplate.
Unless you're willing to fly without a reactor, or life support, or enough cheese dip to keep you going on your next extended exploration expedition.
Well, this is a disgrace!
Said, wanted to be anonymous, but we decided to publish his name anyway, as his parents really didn't think this one through, crew member Jock Strapp. Or Strapper, I would say Strapper to be honest, formerly of the crew quarters of an original Python Mark 1.
One minute you're flying cover against Thargoids, the next you're doing 0G mopping in a Coriolis lavatory block. They promise us glory, we get janitorial duty and an Apex travel cab with no return leg.
Yet, not everyone believes the design limitations are entirely accidental. Observers have noted that while SLF bays are gone, so too are the most expensive recurring liabilities in the galaxy, the NPC crew members who occupy them. Known for demanding 10 to 15% of all pilot income, regardless of participation, effectiveness, or consciousness, many long-serving SLF operators are now vastly wealthy. Some reside in private orbital villas, logging in only to select their share percentage before returning to recreational gambling and cocktail-based weapon development.
This is about fiscal reality,
said one anonymous source within the Pilots Federation.
They make billions for sitting in a chair and yelling, "On it, Commander," and then crashing into asteroids. These new ships are a quiet reset.
The Crewpersons Representation Union of Defence Specialists, or CRUDS, an organisation representing the NPC fighter elite, has accused manufacturers of collusion and is threatening legal action and intermittent dramatic sighing.
Pilots may think they're flying solo,
said CRUDS chairperson Commander Bone Nidle.
But without us, they're just unassisted space loiterers with too many hardpoints. We are the unsung heroes of high-speed Ulloss.
Manufacturers of SLFs have issued cautious responses. Core Dynamics, who make the F-63 Condor, Zorgon Peterson and their tough Taipan, and Gutemeyer and their sleek Imperial fighter, all confirmed a recent dip in demand and a surprising uptick in orders for fighter-shaped minibars.
They're mostly used as trophy cases,
admitted one sales rep, Viscount Lucan de Velvet. That's got to be rude. I can't see how, but it's presumably it is. Gutemeyer's head of Corsair Development added,
"Fighters are terribly good."
Pilots remain divided, but Commander Enid Splatch was rather pragmatic about the situation.
"I replaced my last crew member with a cactus. It responds about as quickly and doesn't take 15%.
With no official comment from the Pilots Federation, speculation continues, whether it's a design compromise or a slow coup against the galaxy's most opulently idle profession. One thing is certain, NPC fighter pilots may soon be forced to consider the unthinkable, actual employment. As one outfitter put it, they had a good run. Well, a good sit."
As the new Gutemeyer Corsair became available to commanders on Tuesday, Hutton Orbital has been planning to welcome the new medium-sized ship to the station. Repair crews have been rummaging in the parts bins for old Imperial courier parts that they can pass off as new Corsair parts, and it's looking positive. They've been trying to do the proper shade of Imperial white for resprays, but decided it was far too expensive, so have settled for mint Imperial white instead. Not quite the same shade, but it's a lot cheaper and tastes like mint if you lick it. Fuel pumps have also been adapted with Imperial specification nozzles to fit the Gutemeyer's proprietary fuel inlets. And a huge stock of blue LEDs has been bought in. The gift shop is getting in on the act two with Empress Arissa bobbleheads, Gutamaya keyrings, and My Other Ship is a Federal Corvette bumper stickers. McThargoids are also catering to Imperial visitors with a special menu. Their signature Empress burger is sure to be a big hit, a spokesman said. We tried to think of all the posh stuff Imperial people might like, then we added four of our big bug burgers and dumped the lot into a sourdough baguette. There's caviar, truffles, we can only get chocolate ones, a bit of saffron, gold shavings, and some of that, what do you call it? Foie grass. We even use proper tomato ketchup. Plastic cutlery and cloth napkins are available on request.
Confusion reigned supreme this week in several outer system colonies after a translation mishap in the Pilots Federation infrastructure systems caused completed security installations to be labelled instead as scientific installations in the French version of local control systems. The issue, flagged by a French commander operating planetary settlements, appears to have originated from an errant localization setting. While construction of a defensive outpost proceeds as expected, once complete, signage, interface labels, and even supply orders rebrand the installations as a center for experimental research.
Nous avons construit une fortress,
said Chief Constructor Gérard Duvet.
Mais elle pense qu'elle est une école de chimie.
Translation for those of you who aren't polyglot. We built a fortress, but it thinks it's a chemistry school. The misclassification has led to a number of operational irregularities. Ground crews tasked with establishing perimeter defences have instead been issued particle accelerators, microscope slides and several crates with Bunsen burners. Reports from one frontier outpost suggest their brig was inadvertently converted into a laboratory clean room and at least one pirate raid was repelled using a hastily wielded neutron diffraction scanner.
Je ne suis pas formé pour cela,
muttered security operative Amelia Fournier whilst attempting to use a DNA sequencer as a proximity mine, which Mr. Dusty reliably tells us means I may have two honours degrees in an unarmed combat, a master's in precision marksmanship and a PhD in advanced dart kicking with integrated explosives, but I am simply not trained for this now. Go and boil your bottoms, sons of a silly person.
Eh merde!
Commented another.
C'est du crottin de cheval encore fumant.
Which loosely translated leads us to believe they aren't a fan of the labelling. Attempts to requisition suitable defence equipment have so far been blocked by the automated logistics system, which insists all incoming supplies must be ISO 4217 compliant for scientific accreditation. One requisition form requesting two pallets of high-yield anti-personnel turrets was returned with a note stating request denied, suggests centrifuges loaded with custard.
I lost three guards as a lab assistant trying to defend the compound using a scanning electron microscope,
said one anonymous base commander, thankfully in English, as our translator runs on the blink.
On the plus side, we now have a very detailed image of the attacker's buttocks.
The Pilots Federation has yet to release a formal correction, stating only that all localization issues are under internal review, and reminding users that a well-placed pipette can be surprisingly effective at close range, and as everyone knows, a sharp retort is sometimes all one needs to fight your way clear of a sticky situation. In the meantime, Command is operating under French system settings and advanced to double-check their installations and perhaps consider lab coats as a new tactical uniform. As one tired technician put it,
ça peut être une erreur d'étiquetage terrible. Ah, mais au moins nos troufions savent trouver une solution correcte quand les pirates de l'espace attaquent.
Which has something to do with their privates.
Good news for fans of North British comestibles. The Pilots Federation have lifted a ban on Tunnock's tea cakes, a traditional foodstuff from the People's Democratic Republic of Scotland and Tierra del Fuego, which were previously deemed as too dangerous for space travel or transport. The danger came from the gooey marshmallow filling, which expanded in low gravity until a critical strain on the sugar chain molecules caused a catastrophic breakdown in structural integrity, followed by an explosion of sugary sweet chocolate and marshmallow. When you're in Super Cruise to Hutton, this kind of thing is inconvenient, but in the middle of a battle, or when coming out of a jump next to a white dwarf star, it can be lethal. No one wants to fend off a pirate attack with a canopy covered in sticky confectionery innards while brightly coloured foil floats around in your line of sight. Not to mention the embarrassment of having to lick the bits off the flight stick so you can see where the fire button is. Back in the day, ship's crews would tell stories of cargo holds creaking and groaning as containers held the saccharine behemoth at bay, or the moment of terror when they gave way, releasing a goon army to engulf the entire compartment in its cloying embrace. Advances in aluminium foil technology and an updated recipe combining improved marshmallow submolecular structure reinforcement and thicker chocolate layering have resulted in a new improved Tunnock's tea cake for the 34th century. The people at Tunnock's have reassured customers that their product will have the same great taste but less space mess, and are still rated as safe for squashing into people's faces as they take their first bite. Coconut snowballs are still undergoing field tests, but initial results are positive.
Welcome to the Hutton BGS bit, where we wait for all the lights to go red and then tell everyone it was always part of the plan. Do you know? I think we may have expanded into somewhere. If you get the time, have a look at BD plus 02305 when you get a chance. It has two Class M stars, 13 non-landable icy bodies, and a Coriolis station. I mean, it's not amazing, but it's what's there, and it'll be easy to take over. So, Hutton now has a presence in 310 systems, and controls 94 of those. Do you know, I remember back when we only had a couple of systems, and all the rest was just green fields. Your booms this week are in HIP 24877, Kokari, Wolf 359, 36 of Yuchi, which is always in boom, and in Ministry. The never-ending story of investment continues in Barnard Star, and there is a massive election in Ross 671, where we are pitted against our eternal foe, Social Ross 671 for Equality. But what does it all mean? Well, who knows? I mean, it could mean anything, but established wisdom says that if you want to mission run or trade, then Barnard Star should be your first stop for the investment, but failing that, one of the boom systems is fine, or in Ross 671 to help with the election. If you want to shoot it, then I suggest you head out to one of those colonies and give everyone both barrels, whether they deserve it or not. And that's it for this week's Hutton BGS bit. That was a lot of French.
Genuine really? French. She
yeah, so we almost had to get a Belgian in.
I know, right?
Oh, but only to polish up the script.
Only for the polishing, yes.
She had so much fun saying those just few lines.
Yeah, good. That was brilliant.
It was fantastic.
She said she was still stumbling over them because they weren't written properly.
Well, we know that.
Yes, we're used to it because we have to deal with that every week.
Is that He's like the Swedish chef. He only speaks muck French.
Is that like McThargoids?
Yeah. Yep. I thought I did my...
You leave McThargoids alone.
Yeah. I thought I did my French lines very, very well, actually.
I thought you mangled the French perfectly.
Nous avons! I just hope Sandrine wasn't listening to that part.
You're doing a literal translation, that's why.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's probably done it using AI or Google or something.
Yeah, artificial stupidity. Google Translate.
You can't beat natural stupidity.
Nope, absolutely.
Can't.
100%. Yep. So there we go.
Natural.
Oh, natural. So, is there a Frontier live stream?
Well, no.
Aww.
But?
There was something several times better.
Oh, the release of?
Yeah. Of? Dun, dun, dun.
The Federal Corsair. Oh, sorry. It's not Imperial, though, is it? It's just a Guttermeier Corsair.
On screen now. Shall we watch the trailer video for it one more time now that it's out and watch it flying around?
Give me a second. I need to get logged in. I'm not on.
That's true, actually. It's not an Imperial ship, is it?
No. Nope.
It's not an Imperial job.
Okay, ready when you are.
It's Imperial-ish. Okay. Incoming trailer.
Spinning space station. Oh,
yeah. They've released the lantern light bobblehead as well. And it's kind of a bit gorgeous. So now the actual trailer.
That was an obvious, wasn't it?
That's the one they've released as a bobblehead, so...
Look at the way the engine is. That did have the look of an advert, didn't it?
Yeah. Very, very, very pretty ship, though.
That is a very pretty ship.
Definitely looks better flying than when you just see the basic stills with its big nose.
Mm. Yes.
Apparently, you've got a ship kit there that gives it an even bigger nose as well.
No way!
Oh, wow. Is that even possible?
Called the Javelin Ship Kit.
The Javelin ship kit. Okay.
Yeah, I may have included a reference to that a bit later.
So has anybody got one yet?
I haven't logged in.
Ditto.
Typical.
I've got... Yep. I've got my...
I think I'll have fun.
One for being sort of part of the thing, in fact, I've got two.
Yeah. Nice.
I need to do an update first. I'm not doing that just now. It'll take forever.
Not actually flown them yet.
Typical.
Is that a Cobra Mark V Delta pack as well? I wonder if it's in the Cobra Mark V Delta pack.
I think the... oddly, everyone expected the Cobra Mark V to be available for credits at the same time. But I don't think it is at the moment. Yeah. The Corsair does fly fairly well. The thrusters are so large, you have to fill it I think you have to hit something like 256 tons of cargo before it even starts to lose speed.
Yes.
That's going to make it great for trade runs in difficult areas.
Yeah, so the its mass is just so far below the that minimum mass number of the the class 7 thrusters, the dirty 5 on. It does indeed boost just shy of 600, as we kind of saw in that trench video from the other week.
Mm-hmm. When I was doing the test on it, it did that. I got it up to that, but you can't get it past 600.
You can. I don't think
you can. No, you cannot.
Scottish can't train. Okay. it seemed to be 598, 599 or so.
It seems to be limited.
Well, I mean, that's faster than most most armed ships can do.
There's no two ways about it. It's pretty fast.
Certainly more so than the Crate Mark II.
Yeah, but the big thing is as well, all right, it's that fast and it's limited to that. But like you say, you fill it full of cargo and it still goes that fast.
Yeah, you get reactive armor. You can just, heavy duty shield boosters on it. Those are pretty, 14 tons each or something. Yeah.
Yeah, turn it into a fighter and just let it go. It's, you boost it to 598. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one thing we noted here is it wouldn't replace something like a Frag Mamba. In fact, a Python Mark II is closer to doing that. The biggest reason is that the weapons deploy in multiple directions, so like a Fer de Lances do.
Oh, okay.
The usual trick with smacking into stuff and just nuking the power plant. Not quite as effective when your weapons don't exactly when your like all the gimbals don't converge on it as easily because they're all deployed in the wrong ways. Yeah. Whereas if you you can certainly put fixed on it though, you can certainly put rails on it.
So what you're saying is that you can't shoot at things that are too close because its big nose gets in the way.
You could say that. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a bit cross-eyed, but out the way.
Its weapons are quite tightly packed, so if you were to give it rails, for example, you'd be doing not a super tight rail. It's a decently tight rail triangle that you'll be doing. You probably want to give it a thermal vent. If you were to hold down Imperial hammers with it, you'll be overheating in a few seconds. So. then class 7 power distributor, if you do back it up with probably presumably a class 3 thermal vent beam, you should just be able to hold that down. Yeah.
Nice. Wow. I'm having a look at the Cobra Mark 5 Delta pack. It's got some paint jobs for it as well. It's got a ship kit. So you get a bit to extend those two wee prongs at the front, the wee stubby prongs. You can extend those out a bit, and it gives it, I don't know, to me it gives it a bit more of a Millennium Falcon look, but also maybe a bit more like a, what's the other fighter? The one that the cops use all the time.
Viper?
I haven't used
The Viper. Vulture.
Yeah, no, the Viper gives it a bit of a Viper look. It's also got, as you'd expect, a big spoiler on the back. With what looks like a photon torpedo in the middle of it, or a photon torpedo launcher in the middle of it. So, yes, that looks pretty smart. Bits that you might actually want to put on it. It's got two triangular bits that sit down around about the cockpit as well for no reason. It's looking good all round. Cool. All the good things are in here.
Next best thing to a live stream.
Yes, yes.
A new ship.
Yeah. I'm just going through looking at all the paint jobs on it now. It looks really good. Right. So we've gone through that, which is all looking very good, very positive. Mm-hmm. What's next? I can't even find the script.
Guess we should probably consider doing some space news.
We could do some space news, yeah. If we can find the button.
There it is.
Nowhere today.
space news.
I'm only attempting to nip onto the BBC's website and look for a couple of things today. So we've got two.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one is about keeping your data safe by hiding it next to the moon.
As you do.
So, yeah, it's a company called... let me see, what are they called?
Lone Star Data Holdings.
Yeah, that's them. So they're going to put a series of kind of data centers, if you like. I don't think they're either. I thought they were orbiting the moon, but they're actually going to be on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how that works, I don't know. So they're going to put these data centers on the moon, and they're saying, oh, it'd be really secure because the only way you know, it's really secure because they're on the moon. Nobody can get to them. And I'm thinking, I'm pretty sure distance for the Earth was never an issue with data security.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I was going to say, hacking is always done remotely.
Yeah, but if you're a company that's got your data on this server on the moon, you're going to have to access it for the Earth, which means somebody can hack in and also access it from the Earth. It's, I don't know what he's thinking.
And it's going to be a real bugger when you need to change out one of the drives in the array because it's failed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or switch it off and on again because it's crashed.
Oh, they can probably switch it off and on again.
Is it just me, or is this a really bad idea?
I think it's probably a dreadful idea.
There's two advantages to it. One is that it means that idiots will spend money on getting to the moon.
Yep.
And two is you get solar power for half the month.
Yeah, and also you don't need to worry too much about cooling it.
Oh, you do.
Oh, really?
Well, for half the time, it's going to be 200 degrees. You're in direct sunlight with no atmosphere blocking it.
Yeah,
the ultimate sunny day.
You can stick a parasol on it.
Mm. And the other half, it's going to be minus 100 and something.
Yes. Well, no, because if it's landed and situated on the moon, the moon is tidally locked, so it's not going to see shade.
No, the moon's tidally locked to the Earth.
2 weeks of light, 2 weeks of dark, 2 weeks of light, 2 weeks of dark, 2 weeks of light, 2 weeks of dark, rinse, repeat.
Until it breaks.
Mm-hmm. And it is really, really bad for batteries. You may notice that all of the lunar probes that have gone up recently have had a 2 week life, because once it goes dark, they lose solar power and they don't come back on the other side. So I guess if you just want to store your data somewhere really secure, honest, Gov, for 2 weeks.
The other part is, somebody's going to put an AI on one of them, and then it's going to become self-aware, take over the moon, and that's it. It's got a Death Star.
Honestly,
I might have exaggerated slightly.
Putting AI up there is one of the few things where the kit might cost more than the launch costs. Have you seen the price of current model AI chips?
Oh, God, I can imagine.
The
Chinese have done that one.
Yeah, so they said, but yeah, don't go into that one. Yeah,
oh, the latest
NVIDIA AI card, so the commercial version rather than the desktop graphics card one, it's got a little bit more memory and a slightly bigger chip, is something like $12,000 list.
Okay.
Per card.
Nice.
And you need tens or hundreds of them if you want to do anything serious in AI.
Yeah. Well, this has actually mentioned difficulty of finding suitable sites on Earth. I'm sure you could find somewhere more suitable than the moon.
Well,
you know what I mean?
The
middle of the Sahara Desert's going to be more suitable than the moon. Mm-hmm. It says the ever-expanding use of artificial intelligence, AI computing, has seen a massive increase in the amount of data that needs to be stored and processed around the world. Yeah, they are going to put an AI on it in the moon.
Has anybody considered bandwidth?
It's going to be interesting, yeah. I'm just looking to see if it mentions bandwidth, but no, it doesn't really seem to, not at the moment.
Because the bandwidth of the moon is, frankly, pants.
Here we go.
I guess I suppose the the idea would be that you send it the AI request and it does its thing on the moon and then just tells you back what the answer is.
Yes, but you've got to dump your training set up there, and that's quite big.
Can you not train it before it goes?
Yeah, but only once. And they tend to retrain models regularly. That's how they have to keep up. Otherwise, you're sending up a new one every 3 months.
Mm.
But, I mean, the bandwidth. Recently, and it was like a year or two ago, the ISS got high-speed internet.
Yeah.
By which you can take probably slower than anybody on this call has got.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
High-speed internet.
Well, I can, again, a bit of experience from the past. I can say that typical Earth imaging satellites over the air can downlink images at 300 megabits a second.
Yeah, but that's from relatively near Earth orbit.
Yeah, it's from around 800 kilometers up. Yeah, that's true.
Not.
But although that's further, what I'm saying is that's further away than the ISS.
Oh, yeah. But once you get the difficulty is continuous coverage for the ISS. They can get a fast uplink briefly while they're traveling over a tracking station, then they lose it again. They finally got that more or less sorted for full cover all the way around the orbit. But once you're up on the moon, that's 400,000 kilometres instead of 800. So that's 500 times further with a distance squared.
Well, you need a really, really, really big antenna to combat that's pointing more precisely.
Mm-hmm.
Which you could actually do if it's on the moon, and that is one of the limitations of a satellite, of course, is that it can't have massive antenna with a lot of power.
Yeah, but the Earth side, the ground station, still needs to be everywhere.
Yeah. Here's one as well. They're saying, meanwhile, Lone Star founder and chief executive Chris Scott says space-based data centers can help organizations meet regulations about data sovereignty, the need to hold people's data and the country of origin. Under space law, the box of electronics is literally under the law of the licensing and launching state. It is an actual embassy in space, he says. It actually isn't. But, you know. They already have customers lined up, including the state of Florida and the Isle of Man government. Oh, right, okay.
I think that's all you need to know, isn't it?
That's all you need to know, yeah.
Yeah, cats with no tails and Floridians.
Yeah, they're all going to think they've got an embassy in the moon.
Yeah.
God,
should we move on to the next story?
I think we probably should.
What's this one?
What is the next story? Oh, the asteroid's back! But it's not in danger of hitting the Earth now. They reckon it's got a chance that it might hit the moon.
Yep. It's decided it doesn't like us. We smell too bad.
So, it looks like... by the way, you can guess at any time to read these.
Do they know what will happen if it does hit the moon?
Not a lot. You'll see a bright flash from it. Well, relatively. There will be a naked eye visible brief flicker of light from wherever it hits, and there will be a moderately small new crater.
If it hits the moon on the light side, we'll see the crater.
Yeah. Yeah, I have no idea it's going to hit.
The chance of it hitting the Earth is now 0.004%.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not much. I mean, are the odds?
Is that up or down? I can't remember.
It's down.
It's pretty stable now. It's
But the chance of it hitting the moon in December 2032 has more than doubled from 1.7 to 3.8%.
That's still not much.
No. Nope.
Yeah.
The article says it's a 96.2% chance it won't hit.
So how unlucky do you think it would be if this thing whacks the moon and it destroys all the data of the Isle of Man?
And nobody in the Isle of Man can get a housing application through?
No, that would be hilarious.
Yeah.
The ultimate insecurity. Spot. Yeah.
Yeah, oh, they're saying if it hits the moon, it'd be a great experiment, the perfect opportunity. Telescopes would certainly see it, and binoculars might. So that gives you an idea how bad it's going to be if it hits the moon.
Hmm.
Yeah, you might even see it if you use binoculars.
So you're not going to see it with a naked eye?
Looks like a no. I suppose unless you happen to be looking at exactly the right spot at exactly the right moment. The moon's pretty bright anyway, so I don't know.
Oh, well, something else to miss when it happens, or doesn't.
Yeah, or doesn't.
What is it? 10 years or something?
8 years.
8 years.
I mean, it'll be passing in 4 years, but it'll be passing a long, long way away, like way outside the orbit of the moon at closest approach. And that's when they'll get a really solid fix on its orbit and what it's going to do 4 years after that.
Yeah. And there's always a chance it's going to hit something else in the meantime.
No.
No, okay, fine.
Well, nothing of any significance.
Yes, something very dark. What's so that's it.
Glasgow, are you talking about now?
No! It's not. Let's land Glasgow, not again. I've done enough of that this week.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there we go. So I suppose that's it for space news, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In that case, let's exit the space news.
Yeah. When you don't know where to get more space news, 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 space news.
Do we have a word of the week? Mia?
Mia.
Mia. Have we
Mia
lost
today,
Mia?
Gone tomorrow? Oh, yeah, we've actually lost Mia. She's just dropped out of the channel. In that case, we certainly do have a word of the week.
Awesome. What is the word of the week?
Apparently it is throttle bottom.
Throttle bottom.
Yep.
And what does that mean?
A bumbling, inept individual in public office.
Can you use it in a sentence, please?
Just watch me. I wouldn't call David Brubin a throttle bottom in front of Michelle.
I would have used a completely different sentence, but okay.
I'm just reading what Mia wrote for us. And I'm sure she'll be back soon to correct it.
If anyone is interested, the spelling and the meaning is coming across your screens right now in the form of a little ticker tape headline.
I think she just picked this one to watch Vulcarius try and use it later.
Yeah, maybe we'll see. There's certainly a few. If I ever have to talk about Jerome Archer, perhaps. Wait, Jerome? No, that's only the shadow. It's Felicia Winters. I don't know what the Federation fools are doing these days.
Don't think anybody does. Right, so. Moving on from that wonderful word of the week.
Space facts. Space facts. Lots of space facts that everyone wants to know. They need to know. Think from bottom straight to your brain. Beam from bottom straight to your brain. Beam from bottom straight.
Welcome back and forth to Space Facts, in which such oscillatory motion is strongly encouraged. And, like a ship-kitted Gutermeyer Corsair's conch face, it's a long one. This week is all about truckery trajectories, and I'm at least here to present them in a way even little Grey can understand. I can't say it isn't rocket science, although that isn't because it is. It's because only professors of undergraduate mathematics are allowed to use that joke. They've gone and onionized, you see. Fact number one. For a spacecraft under the gravitational effect of one planet, any trajectory it takes can be modeled by shining a spotlight at a flat wall surface and changing the angle to make different shapes. Said shapes are all connected this way, where the common feature is that the cone of light is hitting a flat plane and therefore you're seeing a cross-section where it cuts through the cone. This notion is super prevalent across algebra and geometry, physics, motion, optics, and lenses, so much so that despite trajectories having muggle to do with cones directly, the curve shapes involved are still called conic sections. Hey, fact number two. Orbit trajectories correspond to shining the spotlight either perpendicular to get a circle or with a slight angle to get an ellipse. This variation is called the eccentricity, where a circle has zero and an ellipse has some fraction between zero and one, where the higher it gets, the more oblique and elongated the orbit becomes. The spacecraft zooms past the planet at a close point called the periapsis, then takes a leisurely stroll out along the far point called the apoapsis. Quite simply, a circular orbit at some distance requires a specific speed to maintain, as determined by Johannes Kepler in the 17th century. If the speed is wrong at that distance, you get eccentricity and the trajectory goes elliptical. This asymmetric aspect of the orbit is also modelled by the angled spotlight, with the difference in light level due to one side of the ellipse being closer. Fact number three. If the spacecraft speed is going past the planet so high that the eccentricity goes above one, it follows a new open curve trajectory called a hyperbola. Despite not being an ellipse, the hyperbola is still a conic section curve, and as you can see there, in fact. And the spotlight can model it by shining parallel to the surface. Just as the rays of light now travel out to infinity after arcing around the focus, so too does the spacecraft arc around the planet, then simply never loop back again. A velocity threshold which escapes this way is known by the gratifyingly simple term escape velocity, but scientists like saying positive specific orbital energy. Interestingly, we also get a hyperbola trajectory if we reverse the force so it repels the spacecraft. This does actually happen down at the quantum level, where matching charges repel each other. Fact number four. When the planet is itself orbiting a star, as many enjoy doing, a spacecraft can exploit that orbital system to perform a move called a slingshot, also known as a gravity assist. This involves first trailing the planet's path, in effect riding the orbit of the star, while the planet's gravity accelerates the vessel. The spacecraft whips around the planet with a trajectory like that hyperbola peak from earlier. Then it simply allows the star's gravity to take the planet away, and the spacecraft gets to keep all that momentum. Of course, kinetic energy isn't free and had to come from somewhere. That initial trailing path is actually tugging the planet backwards ever so slightly, slowing its orbit around the star. A typical 4 to 5 ton probe can do this to gain around 4 kilometers a second. Not bad for having no frameshift drive. Despite losing 36 gigajoules of energy, the planet is massive and gets slowed by only 2 picometers per second, adding over just 2 milliseconds to the duration of its year. And very much inspired by Lithobreaker from the other week, fact number five. 4 trajectories around 2 planets forming a binary pair are only 2 types of stable orbit. One is called P-type, also known as circumbinary, and involves a large ring around both orbiting the barycenter in between. The image there is you'd have to imagine a third craft orbiting both of those.
Yeah, sorry, couldn't find
that's
one.
What the that's okay. That's what the binary system would be doing in between though. such a trajectory that I just described becomes stable at around 3 times the interplanetary distance. The other is S-type, which is really just orbiting one planet with some small perturbations caused by the other. Figure 8 orbits between planets are not stable. And indeed, a spacecraft figure 8 between binary planets isn't even possible when the planets are also orbiting each other. It is possible if we use space magic to fix the planets in place, and actually 3 equal masses can all form a mutual figure 8 path, a bit like juggling 3 items. But again, unfortunately, none of these solutions are stable. The tiniest bit of friction or perturbation from outside will ruin them and cause collisions or escapees. And we get quite enough of those already in Hutton Orbital's gin production facility, and that's it.
I'm just very relieved you didn't use the phrase "next slide, please."
No, I just tried.
Me is back.
I'm back.
Oh damn! Oh,
never mind. No, that was good. I came in the middle of that and I was like, "Ooh, orbits."
With shiny graphics and pictures and stuff. It was great.
Yeah, yeah. All the good things.
Graphics.
Yeah, I had some fun derping those animations together in Blender. So. I tried to find one that looked like an outpost that looked like Hutton.
Yeah. You wouldn't find one that's scabby enough?
No.
No.
You certainly wouldn't find three of them to start juggling.
No.
No. Yeah, that thing with the observation with the light and the velocity, like the light level versus the velocity.
Yeah.
It's a great learning aid. They're not directly proportional. But I did take a look at having a go at whether I could match a light level equation to Kepler's velocity equation. And I found that if you square the velocity twice, so you like velocity to the power of 4 is roughly proportional to the light level. So I think there is a relation there.
Mm.
It's just not proportional directly.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
An interesting one for the speed at the... Yeah, let's try that again. An interesting one for the speed that the little dot moves around the ellipse, given the distance away from the primary and it accelerates when it's close, is that the area it sweeps out, if you were to draw a triangle from a point on the orbit to the star, back to the next point on the orbit, the area swept out in that triangle is constant over time.
That is indeed one of Kepler's laws, yeah. Which I decided to omit for the purpose of a...
of understanding, yes. Oh, wow.
But yeah, that's why they go way, way slower when they're further away.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm hopefully that animation kind of captured that as well. If you
it did, yeah.
The ellipse one. So.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to try and put it back up now. The buttons are all wrong for that.
Yeah.
Right. Have you done the thing?
Yep. We did it without you.
So good. Did you like the bot, though?
Well, if you're going to be a throttle bottom about it, we don't need you. So.
Yes.
I would have used a different example in the sentence.
Yeah, I probably would as well, but we try and behave ourselves.
Yeah, you would as well, but you gave me that one to do instead. Thanks.
Oh, God. Throttle bottom. How good is throttle bottom, though?
That's a good one.
It's going in there with Womble Crop. There's going to be a word that I want to use regularly.
Mm-hmm.
I think, apparently, it came up in a play somewhere. I can't remember the name of the play, but it came up in a play and it was the name of some bureaucrat. I think it was some Alexander Throttlebottom. And that's where it came from. And it's become a kind of, you know, synonym. It's become a kind of a way of naming, you know, a bumbling, inept individual in public office.
Bit like a Karen.
Yeah. Yeah, so there you go.
I think then it's time
to
find out whether or not Flossie is ready to delight us all with.
I'm ready.
It's Flossie. It's Flossie,
and the community goes. Hello, Flossie here with this week's CG News. First of all, last week's CGs. support Archer's forces in Chiaradani or support Patrice's interests in Chiaradani. The Archer's forces finished just short of Tier 4 with just over 47 billion credits earned by 4,615 contributors. Patrice's interests finished between Tiers 2 and 3 with just over 20 billion credits earned by 2,992 contributors. So everybody who took part gets the paint jobs, and I think the winning side, which was the archers, also get some sort of power play merit thingies. And anyway, this week's new CG is Defeat Pirates in Planetary Rings of Dawn. The governing faction of the Dawn system has called for support in fending off a spike in local piracy. Harold Gomes, head of security for the Dawn Empire League, spoke to local reporters. It's becoming quite obvious that pirates are growing bolder in recent weeks. We've received alarming frequent reports of attacks and looting throughout our system's many planetary rings, icy rings in particular. Our security forces are overwhelmed and the Imperial Navy is occupied in other areas, so we're asking for help. While piracy hotspots are not unusual, this situation in Dawn has drawn interest due to rumours that Gautamaya Analysis have arrived in the system to track the performance of any newly released Corsair vessels used in the fighting. Dawn Empire League has offered extra rewards to independent combat pilots willing to eliminate criminals and collect bounties in Dawn after registering at Kit Station in advance. Pilots who register at least one contribution by handing in bounties at Kit Station will receive the following rewards: one fully engineered A-rated kill warrant scanner with fast scan and long range modifications, Imperial Clipper Empire Etiquette paint job and Imperial Cutter Empire Etiquette paint job. Credits will also be awarded depending on success tier achieved and individual contribution level. The campaign began today, the 10th of April, and will run for 2 weeks. If the final target is met earlier than planned, the campaign will end immediately. To earn rewards, you must sign up as an active participant before handing in bounty vouchers at Kid Station. Only bounty vouchers handed in after signing up will count towards your personal contribution total. The bounty vouchers must have been awarded by either the system's controlling faction or the major faction aligned with the system controller. Please note, if you have any crew members, a proportion of your bounty vouchers will be automatically assigned to them. These bounty vouchers will not count towards your personal contribution total, and your crew will receive the reward for these bounty vouchers when they are handed in. The proportion of bounty vouchers assigned to your crew will depend on their rank. Be aware that faction state changes and other disruptive events can negatively impact markets and station services and could prevent the initiative from running smoothly. And that's it for this week's CG News.
Flossie told you what to do.
Wow, CG's 2 weeks in a row. Whatever is the world coming to?
I know.
Great, isn't
and
it?
And just having docked at said station, it also has a raw materials trader.
Ooh. You going to trade some raw materials then?
Yeah, I usually can't be bothered to find one normally, so that having stumbling upon them is very useful for me. So,
do a quick readjustment. Right then, let's move on. And next up we have the glorious Beetlejuice and Wotherspoon digesting the news for us. Let's see what they have to say this week.
Look, Imperial, with the Corsair. The great features of your small ship in a new larger format, making your Imperial fantasy more than just a performance. With the power you need to pitch, roll and bask like a baron, you've got time to admire the curves. You'll be able to point your Corsair precisely where you want to go, and ultimately, you'll get there. You're spoiled with 3 medium, 3 large hard points, and you can combat from the comfort of that iconic courier cockpit. While the engineered boost doesn't quite match the speeds you'll be used to in your Zorgon Peterson hauler, you can enjoy life at a leisurely pace. Good to mine. It's all mine. Sorry, it's for mining.
So are you going to trip out a hauler for your next combat mission then?
I presume that's a question for Flossie.
Oh, sorry, what was that?
I've already got a hauler that's tricked out that'll do 699.
Yeah, Beetlejuice and Botherspoon pointed out that the hauler goes 100 metres per second faster.
Yes.
The hauler has the advantage of using enhanced performance thrusters.
Yes.
Which is not available for Class 7. So.
The last time I used a hauler was during the, I think it was during the CG for the Hutton Mug. And it was hauling the scrap to Hutton Orbital several times a day.
I do like a hauler.
I don't think I've used one since.
It does have a, for its size, for its hull mass, it has one massive amount of space.
Well, I mixed my ships up. It wasn't a hauler, it was a T6, sorry.
Yeah, that'll dock it on.
Yeah.
We once worked out, it was a long time ago now, that the, while considering supercruise distances, that the hauler has the highest, if entirely filled with fuel, just fuel tanks.
Yeah.
The highest fuel to mass ratio, like hull mass ratio of any ship, at 2 1/7 times more fuel than its mass.
Yeah, I know people have used them as sort of flying fuel tanks and things like that. And done things like that. I mean, they get a great jump range.
Light blue touch paper and retreat to 10 paces.
Yeah, no, if you see if you check out the FSD, it was before you had the boosters. Before you had the boosters, I think it was doing 30 odd light years.
I think it's prior to the Dolphin. Probably I think it's one of the best ranges you can get. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And then the booster, I think you only had size 3 maybe, and that was the only booster you could put on your biggest booster. But yeah, it's good. So, no, hauler's very underrated ship.
Yeah. Of the small ships, I am partial to the Adder.
The Adder has the taxi. Unique... I was literally about to say, the Adder has the unique position of being able to fit enhanced performance thrusters and having a seat.
It's probably why it's so popular with taxi drivers.
Yeah. And they're cheap.
That too. Probably saves them a fortune on insurance.
Yeah. But there we go.
And spares. Right.
And spares and anything else.
Yeah, I'm sure Lantern Light needed several of those.
Oh, yeah. I think we're there. We've done it.
We're there.
We've made it through another show.
Another show?
Yeah.
Oh, thank God for that.
Remarkable.
It really is. It really is. I'm quite impressed. Oh,
shall we give a gently whispered salute to the world?
Yeah, why not?
For the mug!
For the mug!
For the mug! We'll be right back.
too small. The profit margins never really mattered at all. We're gonna take the cargo where it's needed today. Super cruising all across the Milky Way. We'll take anything, anytime, anywhere. Loading up the T-Nas to the brim with grass. Follow the mark, follow the mark. Yeah, you know just where we're coming from. Follow the mark, follow the mark. Now everybody sing the Hutton Trucker song. Crash into the sun. Swivel acts the pilot on the Xbox One. Alvin at the front, you know he leads us well. Trucking across the galaxy, now everybody yell. Follow the mark, follow the mark. Yeah, you know just where we're coming from. Follow the mark, follow the mark. Now everybody sing the Hutton Trucker song. Today, super cruising all across the Milky Way. We'll take anything, anytime, anywhere. So shout it out loud like you don't even care. Follow the mark, follow the mark. Yeah, you know just where we're coming from. Follow the mark, follow the mark. Now everybody sing the Hutton Trucker song.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of the show. Everyone's buggered off now, so why don't you bugger off too?
Seamless.